If you have your copy of the Bible, let's turn together to the book of Revelation and chapter. I had hoped that we would consider this passage last Wednesday night. We were not able to get to that. We're in a section in the book of Revelation that is dealing with the opening of these seven seals on this scroll that was in the hand of the Father and that was given to the Son, the worthy Son, to open up. And we look together at the first six of these seals, and it's not going to be till chapter 8 that we see the seventh seal. And chapter 7 forms what some would refer to as a bit of an interlude. Now, if we're to try to summarize the story of the first six seals, what is that story? Or somebody maybe want to give parts of it or responses to some of what we considered last time. So how do the seals begin? What's the first one what's a description of? Now we have visitors. You're really supposed to impress the visitors, you know, and let them see that we have a couple of our visitors from Australia here. Pastor Troy Kane and Mark Richards are here, and Troy's going to minister for us on the Lord's Day. So show him. Well, it's great things that you all, right? It's like when a guest comes and you say to your kid, play the piano for our guest. No. All right, so what do we consider? The first seal is, you can see it right there. This is an open book test. Conquest. All right, and it's a conquest. All right, so one rides forth on a white horse. He has a crown on his head, a bow in his hand, and what does he go forth to do? Conquering and to conquer. Right? And what did we recognize in trying to put the scriptures together? That is a representation of Christ and the gospel. Right? So Christ is building his church, going forth, conquering and to conquer. Did it seem like that sometimes to the first century church that was undergoing persecution? So again, remember what a lot of this is about is giving them hope, restoring their confidence in God, the worthiness of Christ, that God's on the throne, God has a plan, Christ is executing that plan, and Christ is worthy. And we're arguing that that is exactly what persecuted people need to hear. They don't want a detailed timeline of what's going to happen 2,000 years from now. That's really of little interest. It's like it would be for you. If you came and said, brother, I'm struggling with my faith. Well, did you know in 2,000 years, Russia is going to invade Israel and nuclear bombs are going to go off and you know, like, and oil prices are going to shoot through the roof. And okay, but if I said to you, if I could give you a glimpse into heaven and you saw there was a throne in heaven and that God sat on that throne and that the angels and the redeemed surround that throne, and they incessantly worship the God that you love and for whom you are suffering, and that this God does have a plan, and that Jesus Christ is unveiling that plan. Even now, he's unveiling that plan, and that this Lamb is worthy. He is so worthy. If you could go to heaven right now, if you could just see what you're going to do forever, if you could catch a glimpse of how wonderful and worthy he is, can't you hang on a little longer? And if he calls you even to die for him, do you see how worthy he is? That's the message of the book of Revelation. I almost want to say, if you get chapters 4 and 5 down, you get the whole book. And whatever else you ask, and it just encourage you not to get lost in, well, what exactly did that incense mean? And what about this bell? Or what about, you know, the rain on this horse? And listen, if you get that down, you get what he is trying to convey and what he's going to get convey over and over again. All right, so Christ goes forth conquering and to conquer. What's the response of the world to what Christ is doing? All right, they try to stop it. How do they try to stop it? What are some of the things we looked at that in the second and third seal? How do they try to stop it? All right, so slaughtering them was one. And the other was economic deprivation, right? The economic deprivation. You follow Christ, you believe what you believe, you may lose your job, you may lose your house, You may lose your livelihood. That's part of the picture that we saw. And then we saw, in a sense, we saw something of, we kind of went in and out of this, that God is going to respond to these things. God is going to respond to what's happening as his people are being persecuted. And you find in the fifth seal that there is the crying out for this to happen. Remember there, we saw the souls of those who had been beheaded, and we saw those who were dying for the sake of the Lamb, and they're wondering, again, this question. And of course, it's fascinating, as being asked in heaven. Again, remember, this is a vision of heaven, okay? So, but they're asking, how long, O Lord? When are you going to avenge us? And we saw how in the fourth seal, there is the reality of war and pestilence and famine. We argue in God's judgments upon the earth. We're going to see later on how they're going to be conveyed under the image of trumpets. I'm going to get ahead of myself a little bit there. Trumpet blasts, trumpets warning, something's happening, pay attention, look at what's going on around you, see something of the wrath of God in what is happening in the world around you. And we saw that. And then in the sixth seal, how could we describe? What was the sixth seal about?
Judgment, justice.
All right, so this very graphic picture of the end, right? And it's put under the category of catastrophic dislocation of the created universe. So the sun's darkened, the picture of the moon turning into blood, mountains falling down, islands being cast out of the sea, the sky being rolled up as a scroll. And it said that anything and everything you would look to for safety and stability and that you knew, that was the world as you knew it, it's like it's gone, right? And that was a picture then of the final judgment and of the last day. Now, as we come to chapter 7, I want to see chapter 7 as a response to chapter 6 and verse 17, or well, verses 16 and 17. Somebody read chapter 6, 16 and 17, a nice loud voice there for us. Hans, go ahead.
16 and 17?
Yep.
Calling to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who is seated on the throne from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can stand?
Okay. Now, this is one of the problems sometimes we have with chapter divisions. Because, you know, so we're reading our Bible, so we finish, we read chapter 6, pray. Next day, we start chapter 7, verse 1. And you don't always look, well, what did the verse before that say? So here's the question. The day of wrath has come. Hide us from him who sits on the throne. Hide us from the wrath of the Lamb. For the day of their wrath has come. And who is able to stand? You put yourself in that horrifying picture in chapter 6. And the world is coming apart in judgment. There's the recognition this is divine, and that is not just divine, it is particularly, this is the wrath of the Christ that we have hated and rejected and persecuted. And this enthroned Christ, who rules over the earth, is showing his wrath, and the question comes, who in the world is able to stand? It's like the question of the disciples, who then can be saved? Or if God's judgment, you ever ask the question, you hear a sermon or you read something and reading in the Bible about the judgment of God and God judging sin and God knowing everything you've ever done, God seeing your secret thoughts, God calling into account. We talked about this, you know, the books are open. And the dead are judged according to the things written in them, whether they be good or evil. And everybody's called to stand before God and give an account. And there's no excuses. I can say, well, my mom and dad, or well, it was my upbringing, well, I was Italian, and you don't understand, you know, whatever, none of that stuff. And when you hear that and you say, this God is holy, and this God is a God of judgment and a God of justice, and this God has and does send people to hell for all eternity, and you say, well, who can stand? I mean, who's able to stand, right? Ever ask that question? All right, well, let's consider from chapter 7 who's able to stand. All right, so this begins, as I say, there is this interlude. And so let me ask somebody to read, just read chapter 7, verse 1. Let's just talk about that for just a moment. Chapter 7, verse 1. Anybody? Go ahead, Sam. Okay. All right, now this is not cosmology. This is theology, okay? So the earth, this is not saying that, in case we have any flat earthers in the church, I'm not aware that we do, but the four corners of the earth is not a biblical, you know, cosmology or whatever you want, you know, whatever term you want to use there. But it is saying, so the four... So north, south, east, west, the four points of the compass, there is this picture of this wind, all right? Now, this wind is not, you know, a gentle flowing breeze. This is like hurricane force, tornado winds. This is hearkening back to the end of chapter 6, this great judgment that is to come. And now again, we're just going to change the perspective. We're going to look at it from a different camera angle. We're going to get a different perspective on what's going on. And that before all of that happens, before complete judgment and annihilation comes and the world and everything in it is burned up, as Peter talks about, before that happens, something else is going to happen. And there are going to be some people, as we're going to see now, that are going to be set apart. And they are, in this sense, going to be protected. And so, again, that's the picture there. These angels holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth or the sea. And it is interesting that it adds the trees there. I actually saw an environmentalist one time with this text put on their T-shirt, "Don't harm the earth or the water or the trees." I was like, wow, it's amazing what you can do with a verse taken out of context. Well, that's, I mean, you can... I don't want to get into that, but that's not what this text is talking about. What it's saying is that final judgment, or that all of this is not going to come to an end until something happens. God is divinely holding back. And you find some of that same kind of truth in passages like Matthew 24, where Jesus talks about what does all of this destruction, what does it mean for the elect? What does it mean for God's people? If God's going to bring this judgment, well, what about his people? And that's a question that's going to be asked, is so often asked. So they are withholding the final judgment. And then it says in verses 2 and 3. Let's just do that. 2 and 3. Somebody want to read 2 and 3? Go ahead, Heather.
Then I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads."
Okay. All right, so before, or in the midst of all of this wrath, as this wrath is going to be poured out, wait. There's a saying, all right? Wait until that there is what's called a sealing. Now, putting a seal. Now, what does that signify? What is it? If you were to see a seal on something, again, this is not the animal, in case anybody. Okay.
Approved or belongs to somebody or approved by somebody.
All right, so what was the first thing you said?
Belongs to.
All right, so it belongs to. Approved by, what's another thing you might say if you saw a seal on something?
Official.
All right, it's official. Okay, all right, that's maybe, yeah, you can have that. It's a potential.
New.
New? Oh, interesting. All right.
Secured.
Secured. Right, so there was a seal put on our Lord's tomb. Official. Don't break this. Don't go in there. It's off limits to you. Belongs to somebody else. All right. So you could have something like that. You saw a seal on a letter. You recognize, all right, that, or on a document, or it's approved by, as a brother said, owned by, protected by. So that's the idea. And what you have here is that these ones are sealed. And where are they sealed? All right, on their forehead. All right, so why forehead? Most of us, or at least hopefully, all right, we have our brain behind our forehead.
Everybody can see it.
Yeah, it's as open. All right, if I got a tattoo, notice I said if. All right, so if I had a tattoo and. You ever seen some? You know, sometimes somebody gets a tattoo, I got a tattoo, and it's what we call tasteful or hidden. And then you see a guy who's got one on his head, and it's like, well, there's no subtlety there, right? This is obvious. Whatever it is you write, if you're going to write something on your forehead, and you're going to have it engraved and put on or marked on your forehead. All right, now, when I say literal, now there's a sense, remember we talked about the difference between literal and letteristic. So if I said it was raining cats and dogs, how do you take that literally?
It's raining hard.
It's raining hard, right? Don't need to hear meow, meow, woof, 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 right? Well, he said, I heard him say it clear as day, it was raining cats and dogs. He said, well, no, it's an expression, and it does mean something. And so to say that the Lord's people are marked on their forehead, does that mean literally? Well, he said, well, yes, and I mean, a literal spiritual mark. That they are clearly designated, owned, and protected by God. Right? And they are done so in a way that is clear and obvious and tangible, and put it there, and you are so clearly marking them. All right, so I think that part we can get. Now we're going to get into a little bit of the more complex, and let me read verse 4 and then touch on 5 through 8. All right, so they're called here servants of God, right? We're going to see that these people, when you ask the question, who is able to stand? Well, the servants of God who are marked are able to stand. Those who are sealed. All right, now we're going to get into a little bit more controversy. And this is one of these, this is a text that, let me read it first and then I'll ask about this. So, and I heard the number of those who were sealed. All right, so this is a description of the servants of God sealed on their forehead. And let me go ahead and just read where they're talked about again in chapter 14 and verse 1. Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written on their forehead. And so the seal seems to be the seal that says, belonging to the Father. All right, so servants marked by God belonging to the Father. I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000. Of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed. So I'm just going to read the names of the tribe of Judah. And then every time you can just add in 12,000 were sealed. Of the tribe of Judah, of the tribe of Reuben, of the tribe of Gad, of the tribe of Asher, of the tribe of Naphtali, of the tribe of Manasseh, of the tribe of Simeon, of the tribe of Levi, of the tribe of Issachar, of the tribe of Zebulun, of the tribe of Joseph, of the tribe of Benjamin, 12,000 were sealed. All right, so they're called servants, marked by God, and now they're given another designation, the 144,000. So who's heard of the 144,000? You've all heard this expression. If somebody were to put a gun to your head and said, what does that mean? Would you say, well, of Go ahead and pull the trigger, because I'm not exactly sure. What cult has made a huge deal of the 144,000? All right, the Jehovah's Witnesses. So for the in Jehovah's Witness theology, these are the special, set apart, and the only, and there are literally only 144,000 of them. All right, so let's talk about this number for a minute. Well, let's talk about, well, first this number, 144, and then the 144,000. 144, all right, mathematicians. What's a way to arrive at the number 144?
Square root.
All right, what is the square root of 144?
12.
All right, so 12 squared, or 12 times 12, equals what?
144.
All right, 144. Have we already seen something with 12 plus 12?
Yes.
All right, what did we see with that?
The elders judging Israel.
All right, so the 24 in chapter 4 that surround the throne. You have later on in chapter 21, you're going to have the 12 foundations and the 12 gates. Foundations, the tribes, the 12 gates, the apostles, the 12 of Israel representing the old covenant people of God, the 12 of the new covenant people of God, old and new covenant people of God together, multiply them, and then times them by 1,000. 1,000 is an expression the Bible uses to describe a large and definite period of time or thing. So for instance, we'll get into this later on, not tonight, but at another. The Lord owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. Now, how literally do you take that? Does he own them on 1,001 hills? Does he own them on 1,005 hills? Does he, you know, so when you say 1,000 hills, he owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. That's meant to thrill you and excite you. You're not meant to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. When Peter says 1,000 years is as a day, how literally do we take that? Does that mean that 12 hours is like 500 years? Never thought about that. Oh, I never thought about that. And 6 hours is like 250 years? Ooh, now I'm getting somewhere. You know, we're not meant to, I don't think we're not meant to take it in that way. It's trying to say, listen, a day is like nothing to you, right? But 1,000 years? You try to picture in your mind 1,000 years ago. 1019. So 40 something years before William, William the Conqueror hasn't gone out yet. I don't know if he's been born yet, you know. What's that? He's been born. All right. He was. But you think about it, that's a long, long time ago. No Columbus, no ocean, no sailing ocean blue, no. That's 1492, hundreds of years in the future. This is a long, long, long time. And so it's saying, listen, 1,000 years to God is like a day is to you. Right? That's what it's trying to say. And so this number is meant to convey, this is meant to convey the people of God, and this is meant to convey a great number. Okay? It doesn't literally mean that those sealed by God, who we're going to see under another imagery, so they're the servants of God, sealed by God, and they use this imagery, that it means that there are 12,000 Jews here saved, and 12,000 Jews, and only 12,000, not 12,005, not 12,000, not 11,850, you know. I think we need to try to get that kind of thinking out of our mind, because we're using imagery and apocalyptic language to come up with these things. Veiling, in some cases, in veiled language. An unbeliever reads this. I don't know what's being talked about. A Christian with an understanding of Old and New Testament is going to have some idea, is going to understand this kind of language and imagery. Now, what might help us to recognize that this is not exclusively Jewish people being spoken of? What about the way this is described might help us to recognize that this is not meant to say that John is now focusing purely upon Jewish Christians or a future gathered Israel? Oh, all right. So, yeah, you're going to come up. There's parallelism in this chapter. All right. So the first, are these the only ones sealed, as it were, on their forehead and owned by the Father? Is it just, are there only 144,000? No. And are all of those sealed servants of God Jewish? All right. And this text itself is going to show that. But what about the way Israel is spoken of in this text? That may be a clue or may indicate that this is not meant to be taken as a roll call of Israel. What stands out? There should be at least two or three things that stand out as you read this.
Well, the biggest thing to me is the inequality in the numbers from the different tribes, because some of the tribes are very small and others were extremely large.
Okay, so you had some big tribes, some little, and now they're all equally distributed. Historically, what had happened to the 10 tribes of Israel by the time of the first century?
They were divorced and in dispersion.
Yeah, if you wanted to find somebody with the bloodlines of the of 10 of the 12 tribes, where would you likely find them? Among the Samaritans. So they were intermarried, and they were for all intents and purposes gone and done. So by the time you come to this, you're not finding people, Paul knows he's from Benjamin. I mean, you have some of that. But these tribes, by and large, the 10 tribes, by and large, gone. What's the first tribe listed here by John?
Judah.
Who's the first one generally listed?
Reuben.
So Reuben would generally, why would Reuben be listed first? Reuben's the firstborn. Why would Judah be listed first?
Reuben lost the scepter was given to Judah, and Christ came through Judah.
All right, so we've already read it, right? Chapter 5. The lion of the tribe of Judah. All right? So Judah's preeminent. All right, who's missing?
Ephraim.
And? Now Manasseh's there.
Dan.
All right. So you have, so Joseph's listed. Is Joseph one of the 12? In the general listing of the 12 tribes of Israel, is Joseph one of the 12 tribes? He's not. So he is split under his sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay? So that anybody who's reading, if I were to read this to a rabbi, he would say, where'd you get that cockamamie list? That's not the 12 tribes of Israel. There's no Dan. And Joseph's listed. Now, there's some speculation with some of this. Obviously, Joseph can take the place of one of his sons. But there's speculation as to why Dan is missing. Dan was a particularly idolatrous tribe. And according to a lot of first century, early centuries theology, it was believed that the Antichrist would come from the tribe of Dan. So however you want to try to understand that or explain that. But my point is that in describing it and looking at it this way, when you see it, you say to yourself, all right, something's different in this. And they're being listed in a way that is meant to catch your attention and perhaps call to your attention that there's something different going on and that this is not meant to be taken letteristically and literally, and that this is not the description of Israel as we know Israel. But under the new covenant, there is something that's called the Israel of God in Galatians chapter 6. There are a people of the promise. There are those who have the faith of Abraham that are described as the seed. And Paul says that there are Jews who are Jews outwardly, and there are Jews who are Jews inwardly. And so let me just say that in the context here, and we're going to now go on to a little bit more here, that what's being described here in symbolic language, the same people being talked about, servants, a large number, Jew and Gentile, God has sealed people under the old, under the new covenant. It's a vast number. It's an exciting number, and he's going to describe it now using a different imagery. So let me, at verse 9, somebody to read verses 9 and 10. Go ahead, Jenna.
After this I looked, and behold, a great multitude that no one could number, from every nation, from all tribes and peoples and languages, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God, who sits on the throne, and to the Lamb."
All right. So now we have another description. We're asking the question, who can stand? Well, the sealed servants of God can stand. The 144,000 who stand with the Lamb, who have the name of God on their forehead, are able to stand. And how are they now described? Verse 9, how are they now described? All right, let's call it a great international multitude. Oop. And every one of those lines ought to thrill us. A great international multitude. International made up of who? Hispanic sinners, English-speaking sinners, Slavic-speaking sinners, white-skinned, dark-skinned, olive-skinned, all kinds of skin colors, all sizes, Australians, Aborigine, and white. This again is meant to. This is part of this is the thrill. This is the fulfillment of the first seal. He's going forth conquering into conquering. Who is he conquering? He's conquering people in Cuba and the Dominican Republic and China and Thailand and Vietnam and Africa and Asia, and he's going everywhere. And by his word and spirit, the one who wears the crown is going out and he's conquering people. And God is holding back final judgment until this group of people is able to stand. Now, I don't know about you. I find this far more exciting than the kind of thing I used to study when I studied the book of Revelation. So there are of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues standing before the throne and before the Lamb. These others are saying, hide us from the Lamb. These are standing before the Lamb. He is able to make you to stand. Scripture says that. He's able to make us to stand. We will stand, Book of Jude says. Now to him who is able to make us stand. You're able to stand. And all kinds of people from all over the world and a multitude, verse 9, how big is the multitude? Try to count it. Well, you try to count it here to give you an idea of the vastness of it. But now what does he say? You can't count it. It's so big. Now, again, somebody says, well, Jim, literally, well, we have programs and algorithms. I get it. I understand. Yes. We could do a census. I get it. No, but listen, this is meant to say, this is like Abraham being led out and say, look at the stars. Can you count them? Your descendants are going to be more than that. Can you count grains of sand, Abraham? Well, I created a program and I discovered that every grain, yeah, okay, all right. But you meant, look at the sand, look at the desert. And your job is to count the sand, the grains of sand. And he says, one day your descendants are going to be greater than, not just 144,000. That's meant to go, wow, 12,000 here, 12,000. Huge number of the covenant people. But now you say nobody is able to number them. Now I mentioned that they're standing before the Lamb. What are they? How are they clothed? All right, what does that convey? We're going to get the answer to that, aren't we? All right, yeah. So he says, verse 13, then one of the elders answered, saying to me, who are these arrayed in white robes? And where did they come from? And I said to him, sir, you know. Isn't that great to be able to say that to somebody? So he said to me, these are the ones who come out, are coming out is a better rendering, are coming out of tribulation, the great one, and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore, they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will dwell among them. They shall neither hunger anymore nor thirst anymore. The sun shall not strike them nor any heat. For the Lamb who is in the midst of the throne will shepherd them and lead them to living fountains of water. And God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. What's that language sound like? Well, yeah, it's a picture. And where else does it sound like in the book of Revelation? Does that sound like anything else in the book of Revelation? God's going to wipe every tear out of their... It's going to be no more curse, right? No more crying, no more death. Former things will have passed away. Right, for these things are faithful and true. So, because some of the limit of time here, let's ask the question quickly about, let's talk about this great tribulation. They are coming out of tribulation, the great one. Does the Bible have a theology of Christians living in and through tribulation? And through great tribulation. So when the end times or eschatology is discussed, very often people want to talk about the tribulation. And one of the things we're going to see in Revelation is there's been 2,000 years of tribulation. And I would suggest that a theology geared toward encouraging people to escape earthly tribulation and not eternal damnation. So I don't know how many of you have ever been at a church or a camp meeting in which the preacher goes to great lengths to describe tribulation that's one day going to come on the earth and promising you that Jesus will rapture you out of it so that you don't have to go through it. How many of you want to live through the great tribulation? I don't see any hands. Well, the only way to do that, you know. And I'm going to argue that that kind of thinking and mindset is contrary to what we're reading here in the book of Revelation. Who did John see under the imagery of the fifth seal? People beheaded. Are you going to tell them, boy, you had tribulation, but it wasn't great tribulation? How much can a starving person starve? How much can a beheaded person they were just beheaded. These are going to be greatly beheaded. And these ones got lit on fire, but in the tribulation, they're going to be really, really big fires. Well, you say, listen, throughout church history, God's people have been burned and stabbed and slaughtered and drawn and quartered and fed to animals. And you want to say to them, hey, Jesus is going to get us out of the tribulation. Well, he does bring them out of tribulation. And they come out of the great tribulation and they stand before the Lamb. And what do they do when they're there? What do they have in their hands? And what do they say? Well, you see what it says there in verse 12. I'll go back to verse. All the angels stood around the throne and the elders and the four living creatures and fell on their faces before the throne and they worshiped God. Okay, now they've been saying salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb. Now, what was that salvation? What was the was it that they got raptured out of great tribulation? What are they celebrating? They're celebrating the blood of the Lamb that made their robes white. They're not complaining. Hey, we followed you to have our sins forgiven, and then we got killed. Okay? When they get to heaven, what are they worshiping. And so you find here this loveless language here in verse of the others, the heavenly creatures, blessing and glory and wisdom and thanksgiving and honor and power and might be to our God forever and ever. This is almost the exact same language as is used of the Lamb. The only difference is that thanksgiving is switched for riches. And if you're a grammarian, you might be interested to note that before each one of these descriptions, it is a definite article. As though they're saying it's the blessing, the glory, the wisdom, the thanksgiving, the honor, the power, and the might. It's emphatic in that. Belong to him who sits on the throne. Again, him who sits on the throne, to the Father who sits upon the throne. And so here they are. Coming out of, now, how many of God's people in this sense come out of tribulation?
All of them.
Do you feel like that's true for you? When the Bible talks about tribulation, pressure, throttling, wounding, discouraging, do you say that only belongs to the persecuted church? And
no.
It's different for them, isn't it? But none of God's people reach heaven through flowery beds of ease or sail the whole way on smooth seas. That's a lie that some preachers and teachers want to say. Come to Jesus, everything's going to be great. Come to Jesus, you'll be wealthy. Come to Jesus, you'll be healthy. Well, listen, in this they're saying, come to Jesus and you may lose your head. Well, why would I come to Jesus? Well, because he's worthy. And because you need his blood to wash you from your sins. And because this tribulation coming is nothing compared to the wrath of the Lamb. And you'll either have the wrath of the Lamb, which will be yours if you deny him, or you'll stand with the Lamb, though you be slain. And so again, brethren, I'm going to argue here as we wrap up and go to prayer here in just a minute, that a first century struggling, persecuted people, I hope and trust, I hope you found encouragement in this. I find great encouragement in this because I need to be reminded over and over again, because when something in the world looks appealing or when the thought is, be quiet and take an easier path, to be remembered of these truths and be remembered of what Christ has done in saving and setting apart a people. Yep, right.
I would just add to that, at different times in history, there has been great tribulations upon the church, and this would be the most comforting of scriptures at that time. I mean, you had heavy persecution during the Reformation.
Yeah. Well, it's happening right now.
Yeah.
I mean, in certain parts in Nigeria right now.
I mean, it's just not first century. Right. I mean, we all got a bad feeling that's coming in this country.
Right. Well, you have. I mean, if people like Voice of the Martyrs and others are accurate, we are living in the greatest time of Christian martyrdom that the church has ever known. It's just over there. And so it's happening with the in Nigeria, and you know, of course, what's happening with our friends in China, and there it's more of the incarceration and the financial penalty. They're not being put to death there right now, but that may well come. And I think we need to be a people. I think that the theology that's portrayed to so many, again, I know the sincerity and all of the rest, but a theology geared to tell people, hey, come to Jesus so you can escape the tribulation, is going to maybe the cause, if there is to be a future apostasy, and I think there is some reason to believe, it may well be that that's the cause of the great apostasy, is people thinking, hey, I came to Jesus to get out of this, rather than I came to Jesus because I needed a Savior, and I came to Jesus because Jesus is worthy, and if that cost me my life, it cost me my life. I'm not letting go of Him. That's how we need to be training the people of God, it is through many tribulations that we enter the kingdom. So, any other, maybe a pressing question or about this, we can always ask later on. All right, we're going to try. Oh, I'm going to really try to be. Let's try to look at chapters 8 and 9, God willing, next week. And then I'm going to have some fill in because I'm going to actually be gone for 3 Wednesdays. I'm going to be two of them, all of them down under. New Zealand's down under too, right? All right. So I'm going to be in the land down under with my friends over here.